each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito along with my co-host Loretta Frelick, and we are sitting in, as we do most Mondays, for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change. And we are so thrilled to be with you, and we have, as always, a very interesting show ahead. Loretta, how was your weekend?
My weekend was fabulous.
Lots of exciting things
happening in our parishes and in our families.
Did you have First Communion at your parishes?
We had First Communion. We had four First Communions last weekend and five confirmations the weekend before.
Okay.
So we've been busy with those sacramental oils. Praise God.
Right. That's right. It's a beautiful time of year.
And
our parish did First Communions this past Saturday. I was so happy to see they had really beautiful weather. You know, it was a nice day Saturday.
Wonderful?
And with one of my daughters, I remember pouring rain and freezing on the day of her First Communion. You know, so we didn't get a lot of the pictures you always hope to get. But it was, she received Jesus, and that's all that's important.
And all those beautiful boys and girls.
Yeah, just the innocence.
Yes.
And the innocence and the eagerness.
Yes.
That they have to tell you, you know, about what's happening and why it's special. I just think we're doing such, it's so different, I feel like, from how I was prepared for my First Communion to really, those kids know their stuff. I tell you, at least at St. Luke's and St. Vincent's, you know, they are prepared.
Hats off. You are right. Hats off to our catechists who did just a fabulous job preparing the children
and
for
the
second
grade teachers.
And the second grade teachers who I could just consider full-time catechists.
Right. That's right. Yeah, that's basically their.
And again,
a little math and reading thrown in.
And again, here we are with the regular shout-out that we have to those that are making our church reopening possible.
Yep.
You know, because all of those extra events put an added burden on the team that is making it possible. The greeters and the ushers and wiping down those pews and being and doing it so quickly and lovingly and being able to welcome the next round immediately.
Yeah. And sometimes, again, dealing with difficult people who don't want to wear their masks or don't understand why they have to have their hands sanitized. And, you know, it's I've been happy to volunteer with some regularity at my parish, and most people are understanding, but there have been times where you don't get full cooperation, and then the result's a train wreck, you know, because it delays everything, and then, you know. So, at any rate, but yeah, a big thanks to the volunteers. If you are someone attending your parish, but you're not a volunteer, maybe think about doing that. But secondly, thank the people who volunteer, because you would not be at Mass if they were not there. There's simply no way that that could happen. So, but we also had on Saturday was May 1st, which is the Feast of St. Joseph the Worker. And this is the Pope Francis, our Holy Father, has declared this the year of St. Joseph. So that's sort of a beautiful feast where St. Joseph, who, of course, was a carpenter as well as a father and a husband, was especially recognized for those particular roles. And I saw Pope Francis, I don't have the quote in front of me, but he said, you know, St. Joseph being a carpenter gets the work done, but sometimes you got to wait a little. So I thought that was a great, like any carpenter, you got to wait a little. But I have had so many friends who've had miraculous responses to prayer through asking for St. Joseph's intercession, and said St. Teresa of Avila, you know, said there was never anything I asked of St. Joseph that he did not obtain for me. And if he didn't obtain it for me, I got something better. And she said that literally everything she entrusted to St. Joseph, she had such confidence in his care for her and for her community and for us as sort of heavenly foster father, if
Amen.
You will. So.
And, you know, a year ago at St. Luke, our parish, everything was closed because of COVID, but we had a drive-by food pantry for Blessed Mother. And I remember everyone was a little nervous, like, well, people are just, what are they going to do, just drive by and honor the Blessed Mother? I said, that's great. I said, well, we're going to dedicate this to St. Joseph. And we are, because you know, wherever Blessed Mother is, St. Joseph is there as her protector.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was her husband on earth, and he was who taught Jesus all of his basic Jewish prayers, and
right.
you know, he
formed
was
him
the,
in his faith.
Formed
and,
him in
yep.
his faith. He was his foster father on earth.
Yep.
So we dedicated the food drive to St. Joseph
oh, that's
as
beautiful.
Well.
That's beautiful.
We got over $4,000, 100 bags and boxes of food.
Fantastic.
Never to be outdone in
wow.
his love for Blessed Mother, and look what he gave to us. So if you have a need, go ahead.
Yeah.
You know, this
but
is.
But don't, like people, if you're selling your house, do not bury him upside down in your yard. That is superstitious. It's disrespectful to St. Joseph. Now, if you are going to pray to him, you want to get a statue and put it in
a place
the window
of honor.
Your home, in a place of honor, where he is respected. Do not bury him upside down. That is superstition. You know, and I know that there are some people who absolutely swear by that. But then, you know, my mother always used to point that out. The whole point of that was then you then pick it, take it out.
Yes.
And then put it in a place of honor in your home. It's like
right.
Mother Teresa, when she saw a particular property that she wanted for the poor, she would put little miraculous medals all
yes.
around the property. But then she'd go get the, you know, once the property was hers, which happened, I think, in every single instance, she would go, and, you know, and obtain them again. So
right.
At any rate, it's he's an amazing saint that this whole year is dedicated to St. Joseph. So if you don't know a lot about him and you'd like to learn more, I would recommend John Paul II's papal encyclical on him, which
yes.
is very simple, very accessible. It's not a big, long theological document. Just sort of explains why St. Joseph is so important in the life of the church. And then Magnificat, if you go to magnificat.com.
Yes.
I think it is. I think it's com and not org. Magnificat.com, they're offering a special booklet on St. Joseph
yes.
for the year of St. Joseph this year. So those are two resources for you folks.
And Divine Mercy, in Stockbridge, has a book about consecrating your life to St. Joseph. It has lots of information and prayers to St. Joseph. And so that is another resource.
Okay. Yeah, terrific. Yeah, there's so many good things out there. You know, you used to have to when you go down to a bookstore and actually buy a book or go to a library. And, you know, a lot of my parish growing up had a library. There was a little parish library where you could get religious books and things like that. So I think parish libraries are long gone now, but they used to be a pretty standard thing. So but now the internet has happily taken the place of that. So at any rate, so May the 1st, big day, St. Joseph, first communions for a lot of people, but also really important pastoral letter came out on
yes.
May 1st. From Archbishop Cordiglione, which means Heart of the Lion,
Cordiglione yes.
in Italian, Salvatore Cordiglione, who's the Archbishop of San Francisco and a very, very good holy man,
yes.
released an extensive pastoral letter, his first, I believe, called Before I Formed You in the Womb, I Knew You, a pastoral letter on the human dignity of the unborn, Holy Communion, and Catholics in public life. So the U.S. bishops are going to be meeting next month in June. And this letter was sort of a precursor to an issue that they're going to be discussing, it's believed, at length, which is the reception of Holy Communion by politicians, not just, and this is where I keep seeing so much misinformation, not just because they are, quote unquote, pro-choice, but because they actively do something and work in favor of expanding abortion, of protecting abortion, of funding abortion. So, you know, people are saying, well, you know, some of the commentary on social media has just been unbelievable. And some of the comments I've noticed have been primarily about this particular fact that, you know, Joe Biden is just pro-choice. Well, no, he's not just pro-choice, because on, you know, the first 2 weeks in office, his first month in office, signed a whole slew of executive orders expanding abortion funding, expanding abortion overseas, reversing the federal ban on using fetal remains from abortions for research, for medical research. He's done a whole—so he's actually taken action on his own initiative with his signature, but for his signature, that wouldn't be the case in Illinois. So he said, not in Illinois, rather, but in the rest of the state, or in the rest of the 50 states. So he has distinctly gone to great lengths to expand and promote abortion, not only in our own country, but also overseas, Loretta.
Right. You know, Mary, before our listeners go, although there go Mary and Loretta on their pro-life tour or train, and nobody is better to discuss this than you with your incredible pro-life credentials, having served as the office director of the pro-life organization here in the Respect Life office in Chicago, all of your ethics and public policy work, all of the ways in which you, one of the things I stand just in regular awe of is your ability to take on Planned Parenthood individuals and pro-choice speakers and debate them and wipe the floor with them.
Yeah.
But before our listeners, you know, think, oh, that's what we're talking about today, what struck me at the beginning of this letter to the people was the title. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. But it goes on, and quoting Jeremiah, and it goes on and says, before you were born, I dedicated you, a prophet to the nations, I appointed you.
Mm.
And while
that's such a beautiful passage.
Isn't it?
That's one of my favorite passages in Scripture.
And while it speaks so lovingly of the purpose and plan God has for each one of us from the beginning of our existence in heaven with God, I think it's important that everyone understand that's what we're talking about.
Right.
We are talking about a unique soul, a unique person created in the image and likeness of God with a purpose and a plan that no one else can fulfill.
Well, right, and we'll never exist again. We'll never exist again. And, you know, that's you just think. And then, you know, there's a lot of research now. In fact, the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, has a couple of papers on this about the cells of every child a woman has carried, whether it's aborted or even miscarried, or any child that you have, that child's cells remain within you for your lifetime.
Yes.
And so you carry the cell, even if you abort that child, you carry that child's cells with you. So that's how deep the maternal fetal bond is, the maternal unborn child bond is that you actually will carry that child's cells in your body. And again, not crazy. I'm not making this up. This is not from the Bible, everyone. This is from the National Institutes of Health. And we have terrible internet access in here today, people, but microchimerism, I believe, is what it is called. And it's really just fascinating, you know, from a biological perspective, how before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. I knit you. You knit me in my mother's womb. I mean, Scripture references back, right, to all these ways in which God forms us as unborn children. Of course, Jesus himself was an unborn child. First person to recognize Jesus in Scripture was another unborn child when his cousin John the Baptist leapt for joy when Mary came into the presence of his mother Elizabeth. So we know just by looking at Scripture, you know, this is so funny. One of the other tired arguments that the pro-abortion people often use is, you know, name one place in Scripture where abortion is condemned. Now, you know, this is absurd, as if Jesus would have said, yes, it is okay to go ahead and kill an innocent unborn life that I have created. God have uniquely formed and created. But beyond that, the first kind of manual of Christian discipline called the Didache, which was written by Jesus's first followers, including, it's widely believed, some of the apostles who had not yet been martyred. So it was sort of a way of life written down so that the first community would know how to live. It explicitly, by name, condemns abortion in a Roman Empire where it was widely practiced. So the first Christians believed it.
And Dr. Mike Aquilina talks about it in his lectures. And his book, and the title escapes me right now, but you can look up Aquilina. He talked about how in the early Christian community, it was the Christians that changed the world.
Right.
And when there was a baby that was born, the male or female, the father had to acknowledge it by either looking at it, touching it, somehow blessing it. So the chances were, if this baby were deformed, it wasn't going to happen. If it had a cleft palate, it wasn't going to happen.
Right.
If it was a girl baby, it was going to be left at the dump. And that's where the Christians used to go and reform the culture.
Right.
They took those babies into their homes and cared for them and loved them and raised them.
And isn't that, that's an interesting point you raise, because even now, sex selection abortions, they're still completely legal in the United States, for those of you who don't understand what Roe versus Wade did. The vast majority of sex selection abortions occur on baby girls.
Yes.
For no other reason than that they are baby girls. And all we have to look at is China.
Yes.
And certain parts of India. In fact, there were three villages in India, this would have been 2 years ago, where in a three-month period, not one girl was born.
And there's a study being done in China about how they are looking for girls to marry men.
To marry men. Because there's such an imbalance in the male-female ratio, which is, I think statistically, it's like 51-49. There's always slightly more women than men.
Right.
But now theirs is so skewed. And, you know, and this is in the New York Times, which is editorially very supportive of abortion. Big story on how you have these men in their 30s and their parents can't find them wives. And they have nothing. I mean, and the parents are distraught now because they can't find wives. And these men have kind of meaningless lives. They go to their jobs. They come home. They're alone. Parents who don't have the kind of money that, the wealthier families do can't send them abroad,
right.
You know, where they could meet, you know, a Japanese girl or a Korean girl or something and bring her home. And so there's a huge rise in illegal prostitution because the male nature is to want to create and to procreate. And so it has led to all sorts of societal ills. But anyway,
is an aggressive male population.
Yes, that's the other part. And you see that even in animal populations, right, when the females are removed. But, listeners, we're going to get back into Archbishop Corleone's letter for a little bit and some of the reactions to it on social media. So please don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick, and we are sitting in for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Winds of Change holds in our hearts and prayers those who gave their full measure in defense of our nation. Remember their sacrifice on this day of remembrance, Memorial Day. There is a lot to learn at St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy, where faith, virtue, and valor is the Academy's motto, where that motto expresses the values your child will learn here. Stop by St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy's website at ststanschicago.org. There you can meet the teachers, see the preschool, see the school's top academics, the science lab, and the Catholic faith. You will learn what our families have to say about St. Stan's. While you're on the site, you can schedule a tour to see St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. So rather than hear me talk and talk, go to ststanschicago.org and learn all about it.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. It's not too late to register for the 2021-2022 school year at St. Stan's. Seats are limited. For more information or to schedule a tour, call 773-278-4560.
773-278-4560. And you're listening to the Winds of Change.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
And welcome back. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame, along with the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I am joined by my co-host, Loretta Frelick, who is a very recently retired criminal prosecutor for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. So stay out of her way if you're doing something wrong, because I don't think you're not carrying a badge with you anymore, I know. But still, she very, very bravely prosecuted very, very evil people, taking on crimes like child sex offenders and other things people would not want to touch with a 10-foot pole. Loretta very bravely went into courtroom after courtroom and made people who were doing bad things to children pay. So, Loretta, thank you for your service.
Well, thank you. I had great partners and a child protection unit that supported all of our efforts. So yeah. God is good. I had wonderful supervisors. I have been blessed. And now I'm blessed to be on this show with you.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You were so kind to mention my pro-life work and, you know, my debating skills and that sort of thing. But you know what? I had that very same opportunity to be mentored by and to be taught by others. I mean, I just didn't pop out, you know, of the womb like this. I
doubt that, Mary.
Well, no, true. I mean, maybe as my mother said, you came out of the womb talking. But I mean, my little baby picture, you know, the terrible one that they take in the hospital. My mouth is open like I'm trying to say something. But Helen Alvray, who used to be the spokesperson for the U.S. bishops, she was a great early mentor to me when I was in law school. And then just so many others, Cardinal Francis George, Cardinal Bernardine, who hired me to work in his pro-life office and really, you know, schooled me in the whole consistent ethic of life and the consistency of the church's teaching. So I, you know, that's how God creates us, right? We're born into our family.
Yes.
We are societal people who are meant to be in relation with each other. Jesus himself, when he came as a human being, born into a family, we are meant to be relational with each other. You know, that's why, again, the church holds St. Joseph in such great regard. But listeners,
I think we would be remiss if we did not add that strong women had strong mothers.
Yeah.
And I can honestly tell you that they also had a connection to the best mother of all, Blessed Mother, who we celebrate in a special way.
Right, and during the month of May.
During the month of May.
Would you just, and not only is it Mother's Day in the month of May, but also we honor Our Lady in a special way. Do you want to mention that?
Well, it's May is the month of the Blessed Mother. And I don't know if you were, when you were growing up, I had a wonderful third grade teacher, Mrs. Doherty, and she had all of us in the third grade making Blessed Mother shrines in our bedrooms.
Oh, that's beautiful. I wish people would bring back home shrines. I feel like, you know, over the years, because I worked for the church, listeners, as many of you know, for a couple three decades. And so people all often, and I consider it a compliment, gave us religiously themed gifts.
Yes.
I mean, for our wedding, and when I got married and for other things, someone just gave me a beautiful icon of St. Joseph as a thank you gift for something I wasn't expecting to be thanked for. But, you know, like somebody came into my house, she's like, I kind of feel like I'm in a convent when I'm at your house sometimes. Because, like, do you have any art that's not religious art? So, again, I consider it a compliment.
I can attest you do.
But you know what? But I had a priest friend. No, this was when I was young, in my early 20s, who told me, he said, if there's one thing I would recommend to any young couple, the first thing you get is a beautiful image of Our Lady. He said, I don't care what it is. Is it a Balik statue or it's a framed painted image? Get one. It can be an artistic and expensive or as inexpensive and have one image of Our Lady in your home.
Yes.
And we did that. We have a beautiful framed image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and we got engaged right after I had gone to Mexico City for her feast day on December 12th. And so I have a special, you know, kind of affinity for her with our marriage. And we put that up in our home. And, you know, we've had every other kind of trial and tribulation, I think, as many married couples do. But I've always felt like Our Lady's always sort of had a protective mantle over our home.
Amen. You know? And, you know, my life is filled with those kinds of stories as well. I can remember, I mean, I still have my First Communion Blessed Mother on my dresser.
Do you really?
I do. And
my miraculous medal. The ages. Yeah. Oh, do you know, my uncle was a priest, my mom's brother, and from Scotland, and sent the most beautiful solid gold miraculous medal from Spain, and it got lost in a move.
Oh.
I know. It's one of my greatest heartbreaks for my baptism. I know my mother, sorry, Mom, she's up in heaven now, but with him. And now he knows that she lost it. But that was always a great sorrow for her that somehow went missing. But maybe, you know, I always think, maybe somebody found it who really needed to have it, you know, and more than me. And maybe God used it as a a sign of hope for somebody who was desperate. But
this is also an opportunity to rededicate ourselves to saying the rosary.
Right.
So even if you just start it for the month of May,
right.
I can always remember my mother, that was always something she said, Loretta, go get my rosary. Loretta, my rosary's on the front porch. Loretta. Yeah. And it was always something that was close by, and I am now the recipient of that rosary.
Oh,
and
beautiful.
It was a wedding anniversary gift from my grandfather to my grandmother, who also has the same name. So it's a real treasure.
Isn't it? You know, I had been praying when I was praying that God would send me the right person, you know, and praying for a good husband and a holy husband. One of the first gift when I was dating my husband that he ever gave me was a beautiful gold rosary box.
Yes.
So, you know, that I have not lost that. So thank goodness. But
and you haven't lost Kevin.
Who I haven't lost my husband.
A wonderful answer to prayer.
Right. No,
but
he is.
Maybe, Mary, we could talk a little bit more about the cooperation.
Yeah. So listeners, if you're just joining us now, we are talking about a pastoral letter that was issued on Saturday by Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone, who is the Archbishop of San Francisco. And you can just go to the Archdiocese of San Francisco's website if you'd like to read it in full. It's called Before I Formed You in the Womb I Knew You. And it is so a lawyer had a hand in this. I know that for sure, because it is so organized, well laid out, and well argued. He begins by talking about science and the law, which is wonderful. But in section two, he goes into sort of a particular aspect about abortion and Catholic moral teaching, and that's cooperation in evil. So there's different types of cooperation in evil. And if you remember back to your high school theology classes, if you had the privilege of going to a Catholic high school where this got taught to you properly, you remember that there are formal degrees of cooperation, and then there's material cooperation, which is also serious. And then there's other types of cooperation, like mediate cooperation and remote cooperation. So how close you are to the actual evil occurring and your degree of responsibility. So, of course, you know, there's mortal sins and there's venial sins. So if I get up and I steal Loretta's coffee that I actually bought for her on the way down here, and I take it from her and I lie and I say that I spilled it, well, that's not a mortal sin. It would be a venial sin because I've lied to a friend and stolen something. But that's not a mortal sin. However, if I pull out a gun and shoot Loretta, that is a mortal sin, because taking the life of another is always gravely evil. Gravely sinful, the unjust taking of a human life. Of course, you are allowed, you know, as a prosecutor, to defend yourself and others. So if someone is coming after my children with a machete, I am obliged to neutralize that person. And if I kill him or her in the process, too bad, so sad. You have a right to defend yourself and others. What you do not have a right to do is to privately kill someone who is innocent. And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about abortion. But Archbishop Cordileone goes into good detail with this. And what he mentions in his letter, and I don't want to read to you, but there's a couple of key passages I really want you to hear. The key to formal cooperation is that I will the evil that is being done by another, and my cooperation is given to help bring it about. So that this applies, he says, clearly to those who willingly kill or assist the killing of the child, but others who either pressure or encourage the mother to have an abortion, they pay for it, they provide financial assistance to organizations that do abortions, or they support candidates or legislation to make abortion more readily available with that specific intention. So I'm voting for Joe Biden because I know he's going to give tons of federal dollars to Planned Parenthood, and they do abortion, and I want abortion to stay legal. So if you voted for him with that specific intention, that's sinful. Now, if you voted for him saying, I just hate Donald Trump, I hate what he's done in X, Y, and Z, other different policy areas, I hate that Joe Biden supports abortion, but, you know, so if your intent was not to support, then it's not necessarily gravely sinful. You have to have, as Cardinal George once pointed out in a talk, a very, 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 he actually said it like this, good reason to vote for someone who's a pro-abortion candidate. But the church leaves open the possibility that could exist. So you can never, ever, ever, as Archbishop Cordileone points out, justify formal cooperation with evil. You just can't. It's not justifiable. You can't come back and say, but what about the death penalty? What about, you know, because abortion is what the church has always taught. The church is continual and eternal teaching is that abortion is a grave evil. It always has been. And to have an abortion, to will an abortion for another, to perform an abortion or to facilitate the performance of abortion is a grave moral evil. And it is so grave, it's an intrinsic evil. In and of itself, it can never be justified. Unlike the death penalty, which the church said is not morally permissible in today's society, it's not necessary. As you well know, you can keep people locked up for life. There's no need to use it. But the church also recognizes, as Thomas Aquinas says, that state has a right to use it if they have to protect other people. If it's the only way to protect other people is to execute someone, a government, a state has a duty and obligation to protect its innocent citizens. Okay? So that's the difference. Abortion can never, ever, ever be justified. Now, some of you are going to say, what about life of the mother? So here, where those situations actually exist, and I have friends who have done maternal fetal medicine for years, those are the doctors treating the sickest mothers carrying the sickest babies. To a person, they have all said to me, I have never once in all my years of treating incredibly sick women carrying disabled children or sick children or children who we know are going to have a limited lifespan, I've never once had to deliberately kill any of those children in order to save the mother's life. There is something within the church's moral law called the principle of double effect. This is often used during ectopic pregnancies where the unborn child has attached inside the fallopian tube. If your intention is only to go in to remove the fallopian tube to save the life of the mother, your intention is not to kill the child, that's morally permissible. If there's a way to save the child, the church would say, try and do it. If you cannot, you may justifiably, for example, remove a fallopian tube under the principle of double effect. So you are not willing or intending the child to die. So does that make sense?
It makes very good sense.
Okay, Mary. Terrific. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I've been going on.
No. We're blessed to have the leadership of Archbishop Corleone. And I know this this letter that he's written is very important. And he's a man that walks the walk talks. I was so impressed when I first heard of him, obviously in San Francisco, when they had the, I guess they would call it a demonstration, I would call it a riot, at the shrine or at a statue
of Saint
in a state park of Juniper Cerro. And what he did was he took a group of individuals and he went and he blessed that statue that had been defaced and had been the center of a protest or riot and, you know, taught the truth that Juniper Cerro was an individual who protected the indigenous people.
Yeah. Oh, no, walked all the way from California to Mexico, walked.
Yes.
I believe with a very damaged leg in order to plead with the officials in Mexico to help with to protect the indigenous people that have come that were living in California. Absolutely. There's
and
no
moved,
question.
Moved the city that the or the camp that the local people lived in that was right next to the garrison that the Spanish soldiers were taking the opportunity to abuse them, moved it from the garrison into further inland. And so that's why the garrison is still on the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And the town that the Indians lived in is further away to protect them so they would not be in close proximity to the Spanish soldiers.
So Archbishop Corleone has been also a great champion of religious freedom.
Yes.
Going to the Supreme Court, in fact, to enable his churches to be able to open in a limited and safe capacity for worship during the pandemic. So just a great stand-up guy. Again, this Section 2, Cooperation and Moral Evil, really important section. It goes into not only formal cooperation that I've just mentioned, but also material cooperation and mediate cooperation and then remote cooperation. So if you want to know, like, oh my gosh, you know, I gave $10 to Planned Parenthood not knowing that they did abortions, would that be formal cooperation? No, of course not.
Right. And he ends his letter with a shout out to all the pro-life workers.
Yeah, he does, which is beautiful.
And has been nothing but attacked on social media. And so you want to...
Yeah, Twitter and Facebook have been a cesspool this weekend. Not like they're ever not as... Well, anyway, it's the attacks on him have just been, some of them, frankly, by other Catholics, I have found nothing short of scandalous. But he tweeted out just a short time ago, about 2 hours ago, I think in response to some of the reaction. And a lot of the reaction, I must say, was very positive. Like, thank you. Thank you for speaking so clearly. Thank you for laying this out, this whole argument out, in a way that everybody could follow. We start with the law and the science. We go on to what the church teaches about cooperation. And then we go on to, you know, what we do to love, what love of neighbor compels us as Catholics to do. But I'll just read you the tweet, and then we're going to go to our next break and our next guest. But he tweeted out 2 hours ago, "It is not politics that matter the most." And that's what everybody's been obsessing over. You know, Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and communion. "It is not politics that matter most. It is souls. It is the courage to speak the truth and defend what is most important. The sacredness of the Holy Eucharist and the sacredness of each and every human life for whom our Lord Jesus Christ died." So again, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Go to the website for the Archdiocese of San Francisco, and you can get it. Follow Archbishop Cordeleon and back him up on Twitter. Give him those likes. Back him up on Facebook. And if you're on TikTok, I am not. I avoid it like the plague because my teenagers are on it. Try and back him up there. So, and on Instagram as well, from what I understand from my teenagers. So, but again, I cannot recommend it to you, and I would read it in a very prayerful and reflective way. If you don't agree with the church's teaching, ask God to open your heart, maybe to make you aware of some things you might not have been aware of. So we're going to go to our next break, and we got a terrific guest coming up in the second half that Loretta has arranged for us. So really looking forward to speaking to him. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick sitting in for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Winds of Change holds in our hearts and prayers those who gave their full measure in defense of our nation. Remember their sacrifice on this day of remembrance, Memorial Day. St. Stan's needs your help. We are forming a group of volunteers called St. Stan's Cares to help parish and school families in times of need. To join the group or learn more, please contact Brian at 312-343-3222, and we will plan an upcoming virtual meeting to discuss the details. Almsgiving, it's one of the three pillars of Lent. Volunteer with St. Stan's Cares as a means of almsgiving.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
There is a lot to learn at St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy, where faith, virtue, and valor is the Academy's motto, where that motto expresses the values your child will learn here. Stop by St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy's website at ststanschicago.org. There you can meet the teachers, see the preschool, see the school's top academics, the science lab, and the Catholic faith. You will learn what our families have to say about St. Stan's. While you're on the site, you can schedule a tour to see St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. So rather than hear me talk and talk, go to ststanschicago.org and learn all about it. This is Bold Talk with Father Thomas Loyola.
Another venerable sanctuary of positive male development has caved to the forces that seek to deny God's order of sexual complementarity. Boy Scouting is now just Scouting, as it has become mandatory for Boy Scouting to include girls and female Scout leaders. The same coup, however, has not befallen Girl Scouting, as they proudly reaffirm their mission to serve girls only. It is just another repeat of the Garden of Eden. Like Eve and the serpent, womanhood has fallen for another bad line. For men to develop into authentic men, capable of loving, protecting, cherishing, and serving womanhood, separateness is needed. Boys and men need venues in which males learn from other males how to be real men. Invading domains of proper male development neither serves or complements womanhood. It says that maleness is the standard, and unless women are wherever a man is at all times and in all things, womanhood has no intrinsic value of its own. It is also saying that the guys have put together a more desirable product than the girls. Why doesn't Girl Scouting suffice for the girls? The rules and standards do in fact change whenever girls are inserted into venues designed exclusively for male development. In the end, it is womanhood that is denied that authentic, fully developed male that God intended for her from the beginning.
Welcome back. This is Loretta Fralick and Mary Helen Fiorito, guest hosting for Father Anthony Bush on Winds of Change. And this afternoon, we are excited to welcome Dan Herbert to the program. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
It's our privilege. For our listeners who don't know, Dan is a former police officer. He was a police officer for 9.5 years and taught at the academy. He's also a former prosecutor and currently is a defense attorney. And some of you may have seen Dan on some of the podcasts that he's been on and certainly the television interviews regarding the recent Derek Chauvin trial. And Dan is here to talk to us today about an amazing new endeavor that he's engaged in, Bank the Blue. Welcome, Dan. Can you tell us about...
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Can you tell us about Bank the Blue?
Yeah, I love your description. We are really excited about Bank the Blue. We kicked it off with really unfortunate timing. We kicked it off kind of at the right before the pandemic hit, but... Bank the Blue is a not-for-profit organization that, you know, it really has been in the works for a couple of years, and it's kind of morphed into a few different things as we went through the process. But what it's focused on is providing mental health services for police officers right now throughout the state of Illinois, and we do plan on taking this nationally as well. And there's some really unique things with our charity that is addressing a need that is just not covered. And probably the biggest thing is that we have mental health support from providers who specialize in treating police officers in the traumas and stresses that they go through. And critical to our mission here is that this is something that is 100% separate, complete, and secret from the employer in this case, which is a big fear for a lot of police officers.
Well, you know, can you share with our listeners why that's a fear? You and I both understand why that is a fear, because obviously if their employer learns that they could be subject to not being able to work, right?
Yeah, and especially with police and their requirement to carry a firearm, there's some kind of antiquated laws out there, but you know, police officers are extremely concerned about the stigma of mental health.
Sure.
From the standpoint of they're fearful that their FOID cards, the firearm owner identification card, which all gun owners have to have, including police officers, and the Illinois State Police can revoke or suspend those FOID cards for a variety of reasons, and one of them is for mental health issues. So these police officers are, and what happens if they lose their FOID card, it's suspended or revoked, is they don't get paid. And, you know, unfortunately, we have some very clear examples of, you know, police departments in general, you know, a lot of them do really good for these officers. You know, a lot of them, unfortunately, just kind of speak a good game, and then in practice, we have dozens of examples where police officers have reached out for help, and the department has used that in a punitive way towards
right.
these officers.
Well, I find your unique approach from reading your website and the press releases that you want to help the police officers, you want to help the community, and you want to help the departments. And that's a pretty big order, but you've got a beautiful website that I had an opportunity to go on, and it's pretty easy to use. It's impressive.
Yeah, we have one of our co-founders, Carmen Daniel. She's excellent at all the social media, and she really has created an interactive and informative website. And when I talked about this evolving throughout the years that we were planning it, it certainly started, and its main focus is going to be on mental health of officers. But, you know, we recognize that every one of us wants to have a healthy, a mentally sound and healthy police department that's enforcing the laws. So that's why we really want the community to recognize the importance of this. And also, you know, one of the biggest stressors for police officers is that they don't feel this job satisfaction. They all come out of the academy wanting to save the world, expecting to do it, And at some point, after witnessing all this trauma, and especially now just receiving so little support from their supervisors, the community leaders, and the community in general, we need to have the community understand, recognize the good that the police officers do, and then in which case, when the police officers feel like that their job is being respected and appreciated, that will do as much for the mental health as anything.
Yeah. Dan, this is Mary Fiorito speaking again. I joined Loretta in thanking you for giving us your time. My husband's father was a Chicago police detective and who sadly died before we got married. But one of the things my husband always talks about when he's describing him is that he would never talk about his work. Ever. He just couldn't do it. He didn't want his grandkids. And it was over at my husband's house quite often. There were six kids growing up. And he said, you know, there are just things you kids don't need to know about. And I think my husband always sort of felt like, in a way, it hardened him in a way, because he felt like he couldn't, he shouldn't. Some of the things, I think, when he was older, when my husband was in college, he said, you know, you have no idea what a police officer sees on a weekly basis. And again, if you have no one to process that with in a safe way, where you feel like I'm not going to be jeopardizing my livelihood if I speak to someone about this, you know, I was just thinking today, because someone posted a picture on Twitter of the staircase where Paul Bauer was killed. And Paul and I went to high school together, and he was a friend of my brother's. And
he was quite a guy.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wasn't he a good guy? And,
He was tremendous.
He did, last time I saw him in person, he did the security for Cardinal George's funeral. And so, I remember being in the car and just hearing the WBBM report, and they at first said Paul Brower, and I thought, oh good, it's not him. And then my mom called, and my mom said, Mary, I think it's Paul Bauer. And I said, no. And she said, high-ranking officer. She said, Mary, I think it's Paul. And my brother was just, and I remember for like a year, Dan, after, I mean, and I'm not, you know, I hadn't seen him in a while. Like, we weren't super, he was good friends with my brother, but I wasn't super close to him. I couldn't watch or even think anything, but I'd start to cry. You know, you think of his wife and his daughter, but I can't imagine, like, you must have this within the force where there's, you know, something like this happens, and like, would you find that with someone's partners or there were a whole bunch of people that reported to Paul, right? So would that be sort of an area in processing that sort of grief that your organization would work with?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, that's a big part of it, because, you know, police officers, they do, they feel that trauma when there's such a horrible tragedy like that. I consider myself fortunate enough to be able to go to the services for Paul Bauer. It was, you know, we were wrapped around blocks.
I watched it. Yeah. In fact, our other high school classmate, who's now a Catholic priest, Father Mike McGovern, who's now a bishop, actually, was one of the concelebrants. And, you know, he was telling me just about how, you know, how Paul's horse kind of stopped, as if Paul's horse knew that something was wrong. You know, just everything about that moment. I watched. Yeah. You couldn't watch it and not cry.
Yeah, it was so overwhelming sadness.
Yeah, right.
And just, you know, doing something, which is what he was supposed to do, and go out chase somebody with a gun and
someone,
what happened.
Yeah, you know. And someone who never should have been out anyway.
Right.
You know, I mean, how many? He would 4 previous felonies, something like that. So at any rate,
right.
Because that always, when I think of police trauma, you know, I think those two things will forever be connected in my mind. But I'm glad it sounds like your program's far more expansive than that.
Yes. And, you know, Dan, my cousin was John Robert Thomas, first deputy superintendent.
What a guy.
Oh, what a guy. I could tell you stories. I'm sure you know some. But, you know, it was when I saw how the police department came together to wrap their arms around his family and our family. And this is what I would hope for the community, because we all know that 99% of the police officers that sign up for the job and go out, put on their gun and vest to do their job, are all guys with great intentions. And I think that
And gals.
Well, I'm a guys in the vernacular. Sorry. All right, guys and gals. But, you know, it's so important to help the community understand that. And that's why I think it's really important that you're talking about rebuilding relationships with the community and opening it up so that, you know, key members of the community can also come together and they can get an understanding of what it is to be a police officer. And, you know, I've had the opportunity over the last couple of years, especially since all this defund police nonsense. I mean, where are you going to go?
Yeah. Who are you going to call?
Yeah.
Who are you
going to
call?
Yeah.
Ghostbusters?
Yeah, right.
And quite frankly, you know, we haven't done a very good job of showing that human side of the police. And when I say I mean the department. I mean,
right.
They're starting to, but we need to reinforce and to re-educate the public that, you know, these guys and gals are out there doing a job. And, you know, especially now with video, we're going to see things that are going to be disturbing. Sometimes they're criminal. Sometimes they're just unfortunate tragedies. What is clear is that, you know, these guys are not acting out of malice or hatred or prejudice. They're acting out of fear. And so we're trying to show the public here, you know, regardless of what you think of police officers, I think anyone but criminals recognizes that we need to have a law enforcement community that will keep us safe. And one of the ways that, you know, the community leaders, I think, are doing a disservice to their communities from one respect that, and, you know, I can understand the outrage and calling for reforms and things along those lines, but they should spend at least 10% of those passions towards, you know, educating their community members that, hey, don't put a police officer in a situation to get scared, because if they get scared, things can happen. So, you know, there's one thing in common. The police do not want to shoot somebody, and the community does not want to be shot by the police. And despite what the narratives are, so, you know, we're not that far apart, because the end goal is the same for both sides.
Yeah, you know, there's a video that I don't know if you've ever seen it that Chris Rock, the comedian, did called How Not to Get Shot. And isn't it good? You know, again, some of these things that people seem not to take into consideration. But can I just ask you, like, just as a former cop and somebody who's doing this kind of work, what would you recommend that the average sort of person like myself, you know, can do other than donating to your organization, which is so admirable? But, like, anytime I see a cop now since Paul's died, in Starbucks or whatever, I say, you know, can I buy you a cup of coffee? And they almost always decline. No, thank you. I'll pay for my own. I say, hey, you know, I went to high school with Paul Bauer, and this is something I try to do every time I see a police officer in his memory. And then they're all they get teary-eyed, and they let me do it. So other than stuff like that, what would you suggest just sort of people in the community do? What's helpful to the police force so that they get the kind of affirmation that they need to be good officers?
Yeah, well, what you were doing and what you do, that's a very good step towards, you know, helping the mental health of these police officers. You know, these policemen, I can understand they have been beaten down so much that in the scenario that you just described, you know, the most innocent, kind scenario, you know, some of these coppers are thinking, geez, this person's trying to set me up here and the department's going to fire me. You know, and that's how much, you know, we have deteriorated. But I think little things like that and, you know, just kind of correcting some of these false and exaggerated narratives. I mean, you know, here, it is so unpopular now to stick up for the police. And, you know, here, I have a very healthy respect and admiration for the police community, which does not mean by any stretch that I don't recognize problems and I recognize problem officers. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to show respect for the organization. And I understand if you grow up in certain communities where your only experience with the police is, you know, they're arresting your father, brother, uncle, mother, you know, it's going to be hard to have the positive views. But, you know, when I was a kid, we grew up in a mixed neighborhood. But, you know, the police, it's not just people of color that the police are interacting with.
Right.
You know, when we were kids, they stopped us all the time when we were out in our car, and they chased us, and, you know,
what
it,
were you doing,
happened.
Dan? What were you doing?
Yeah. Statute of limitations is up, I think.
That's right. That's between him and his lawyer, Loretta. But,
yeah, and you know what? And honestly, not to, you know, I had a couple situations where I was mistreated by the police. And in one of the situations, when I became a policeman, guess who I ran into?
Oh, police.
And I told this guy, you know what? You were a moron. And,
you don't remember me, but I remember you.
Yeah, but, you know, I can't put myself in a comparison to, somebody that lives in, you know, the South or the West side where they're seeing, you know, shootings and they've had much more negative police interactions. But the point is that, it's being done kind of indiscriminately, and we need to kind of recognize that.
You know, I don't know if you watched President Biden's 100-day address. It felt like 100 days just listening to it, that hour. But, you know, what infuriated me most about it was he mentioned, you know, the Chauvin trial and George Floyd, which is, you know, again, national topic right now, perfectly appropriate. Don't begrudge him that. But then he went on to say, you know, and I know most cops are good, and I know them, but didn't mention one, even though just the day before CNN and other news outlets reported that in that Colorado shooting, Eric Talley was the last person to die, which means that when Officer Talley engaged that shooter, he neutralized him. He was and even CNN reported this. And I thought, here's an officer, devout Catholic, and you claim you're a devout Catholic, Joe, devout Catholic who had seven kids. And you could have mentioned his name. He kept, you know, and even CNN admitted, Dan, you know, that probably a lot more people would have died had not Officer Talley engaged him, gave his life. And I was just furious. I said, you know, you say you know them. You say, you know, why don't you name one of them? You know, just to give the police that little bit of encouragement that the federal government doesn't hate them.
Yeah. Well, and I think it comes down to courage. And here, it's very difficult, like I said, to come out and support police in situations where the Derek Chauvin trial had just ended. You know, that was a situation that set back the relationship between law enforcement and the community, you know, more than any other case that I've seen in a long time. So it was difficult to do that. But, you know, we elect these leaders and we expect them to have integrity. And you know, Joe Biden, I'm sure, is a very good man. And I'm sure he does respect police officers. But you know, quite frankly, he just didn't have the fortitude to come out and, you know, say what is true, is that is, you know, here the police are getting the short end of the stick here.
Right.
There's some problems, but, you know, we have to support these individuals.
Yeah. Except, Dan, let's not count out our girl, Maxine Waters, the representative from California who had to go to Minnesota to stir up the crowd asking for a police escort.
They don't even see the irony, you know,
to the site of her protest. So,
yeah, well, when that case comes back to Minnesota for another trial, then the community can thank Ms. Waters for that.
Yes, as the judge reminded everyone. Well, Dan, it's been our delight to have you here today to talk about Bank the Blue. Do you have any events coming up that we should know about?
We do. We have our inaugural event coming up on October 21st this year, 2021. We're having it at one of the most beautiful venues in the city of Chicago, in my opinion, Theater on the Lake, down in Fullerton in the lakefront. And so we are going to be promoting that. We just kind of solidified the date. And then, you know, and we're going to invite you know, the community as well, certainly law enforcement. And, you know, we're doing a lot of smaller events, and, you know, we're kicking this off now as COVID is settling down. And people could go to our social media. Like I said, Carmen does a great job with it, but it's banktheblue.com. And then we have the Twitter and the Instagram. And, you know, people can donate money, they can donate their time, or they can simply come to some of the events.
Well, thank you so much. It's been our blessing to have you today. We wish you every good gift in your fundraiser and in your organization, Bank the Blue. It has been our privilege to have you today, and God bless you for all that you do, Dan, for the police, the community, and the departments. And we welcome you back anytime.
Yep. God bless you and your work, Dan.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Have a wonderful week, everyone. We'll see you next Monday.
And don't forget to say Happy Mother's Day to your mother.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see?